Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with the Kia Stonic. You're closer than you think to a 202 Stonic with flexible finance plans from your local Kia dealer.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan sitting in with you until 3 o'clock. Yesterday we spoke to Maeve on Liveline, and we got a huge, huge reaction to that call yesterday, and people very moved by Maeve's situation. She described to us how she, her husband, had been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's in his mid-50s, and her struggles to care for him at home. And really all she was asking for and all she was hoping for was some respite care so that she could keep going and keep coping with the situation she found herself in. And as I say, a huge reaction from people, and many of them people who understood where Maeve was and where she was coming from, because they were, you know, they had walked in her shoes and they had been down that road. And I want to go to one of those now. And I know Maeve is at home listening, and I hope she will take some comfort from this. Martin Curley, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Martin, thank you for calling us with your story. Tell me about your wife, Julie.
Well, my wife, Julie, at the moment is in a home care in Brondungarvan. But she developed Alzheimer's at about 60 years of age.
How long were you married, Martin?
42 years.
Wow. So you would have been, you know, thinking about retirement, I suppose, coming into your 60s.
Oh, like everyone, we were thinking of where we were going, what we were going to do. And it just disappeared straight away.
And what were the first signs, or did you notice the early signs, Martin?
No. Like me, the same way, they creep up on top of you. You just don't know. And I think it was in 2015, when basically I got prostate cancer. And that pushed my wife over the cliff. She developed, went further into Alzheimer's. Then we noticed it.
Right. And so were you getting treatment yourself at that stage?
I was.
And you were obviously getting worried about Julie.
Yeah. But at the same time, she was too worried about me. Yes. She was more, and that's what she did all her life. She worried about me all the time. But when I got better to the extent, she got worse. And then in 2017, she developed a flu, and I was sent to A&E in the COH, and they kept us overnight. And she stayed a month in the COH at that time. Mm-hmm. And I went up to her every day of the month. And I stayed with her all the time. So then we got the consultant called us aside, and he said, you'll have to make a decision. You need 24/7 care. He says,
But tell me, at that stage, Martin, did you have a diagnosis of dementia?
We had, but the diagnosis is kind of funny, because you go up to the consultant, you sit down, and he'll give Julie a few things to do. And according to how good she does at that, that's how they give a diagnosis. But the killing part about that is at the end of that, he'll come to you and he'll say, what do you think of your wife? How is she progressing? Now, you can't answer that question when she's sitting next to you.
Yeah.
There's no way. So, like, there was one of the consultants who was a woman, brought me out and explained the whole lot to me, and I thanked her very much for that. She couldn't understand me thanking her, but I said, you were kind, you brought me out and explained and asked me, not in front of my wife.
And did you and Julie discuss what was happening, Martin?
No. I couldn't face it. I just was hoping that this was going to go away somewhere or another. And I know now it couldn't. It's a cruel, cruel, cruel disease. It robs you of everything. And you're watching this happening in front of you, and you can't. You can't do anything about it. It's cruel. It breaks your heart.
And did it get to a stage, you were saying, after that spell in hospital that you were looking at 24/7 care? I mean, had you been caring for all by yourself until that point?
Yeah.
And was that tough?
Oh. People don't see it. Because, like, even when I used to, like Maeve said, when I used to go up shopping, I'd have to leave Julie here. And one day I came home, coming back down from the shopping, and she had the windows open. And she was shouting out, I'm being held against my will. And I was being kidnapped. And when you come back and face that, then you say to yourself, what am I going to do? Where do I go? And there is nowhere you can go. This is the one thing about this. The minute you get the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, you have nowhere to turn. Nowhere.
Well, is there, and this is something that came up with Maeve yesterday, is there a particular difficulty when, if your Alzheimer's arrives when you're still a young, relatively young person?
Yeah. Yeah. They will be very slow on giving a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Very slow. Because, like, they don't think, but it is getting younger. I take notice now more so of people, and I can see people who are actually going into Alzheimer's. You can, because you're looking for the signs unknown to yourself, and you're seeing them there in front of you.
How do you mean?
Well, you can see people, they will never talk to you in a conversation, they'll agree. They won't have a conversation with them. If you ask a question, they will never answer us.
Because they themselves are aware, and I think minding themselves and not wanting to be cut out, basically, if you put it that way. That's the coping mechanism, I think, of people who are slipping, themselves slipping this way.
They're trying to deal with it, as you said, and they don't accept it. But this is their way of dealing. But if you're looking for the signs, you'll see them. But if you don't, it's actually, people will say, there's nothing wrong with him. There is, but that's the early Alzheimer's. When Julie got the flu, mm-hmm. It just, the infection of the flu actually interfered with the whole lot, and it drove her further in again. But like when we were told about that diagnosis, there was a discharge nurse came up, and she told us then like what we had to do and what we should be doing. So like we were given a choice. If you don't have a home, you'll be given a choice. You'll get three homes. You can refuse two, but you can't refuse the third one.
These are nursing home options.
Yeah, they're nursing homes options.
And at that stage, like how far gone was Julie's condition? Like, did she still recognise you? Was she able to, you know, eat and mind her, you know, look after her own personal care?
She can eat and mind even today, like, which is good. There's a lot of different, it affects in different ways. It can affect their mobility. It can affect their personality. It affects people in different ways.
And how did it affect Julie?
For me, it was great because, like, she was so quiet and she accepted everything, which for me is great. When I put her into the home, and it's an awful thing to say, when I put her into the home in Ghana, that she accepted it so much that it's hard to believe it. She accepted that it's home. When Connor didn't walk out because they're not Alzheimer's caring, it's not their fault. It's just that basically
it wasn't tooled up to deal with somebody with those that level of care demand. And tell me when that, I mean, because I know having you know, been down the road ourselves and spoken to so many people in this situation, that decision, that acknowledgement that you can't do the caring yourself anymore.
Breaks your heart.
Yeah.
There's no other way. It breaks your heart. Every day, every day coming home from Connor and every night, I cried for 3 months.
That was the first nursing home. That was right after you put Julie into the nursing home or moved her in.
Yeah.
And was that just because you felt guilty, or were you worried about the care? What?
Both.
And I suppose lonely as well, because you've had all those years together.
Yeah, you're on your own. And I have two daughters, Joanne and Louise. But at the same time, you just can't. There's no. I made a decision that I would take out and bring her home and look after her home because when I wasn't working out. And that was a big mistake. So when I brought her home, I kept her for 7 weeks at home on my own help. I was close to a nervous breakdown at that stage. And I was lucky I asked the public health nurse, is there any help I can get anywhere?
Because that's the situation now that Maeve was really describing for us yesterday.
Oh, yeah. And that's when I brought everything back to me. And actually, I was crying listening to Maeve because they was the same thing. And as I said, where do you go? Where do you go? There is no road for this. There's no roadmap. You're just forgotten about. And it's the diagnosis, that's it. Run away now and do what you can. You can't. And I can't understand even from an Alzheimer's Association in that side. So, like, you had to do it all yourself, every bit of it yourself.
I think, was there, like, daycare centres or those kind of options available to you, Martin?
They are there, and there was one in Connor which was very good, my way. But they're under-resourced. Every word you'll keep hearing it, and Maeve said it yesterday, they're under-resourced. When you go looking for help, they'll give you half an hour. How good is a half an hour?
A home help, you mean?
Yeah. Even to get a break, just to go for a walk. You wouldn't be 10 minutes out the door, and you have to come back again. So that's no good. So I was lucky. I got Julie into a HSC home in Dungarvan Community Hospital. And that's when I started living again. Because the care that she gets down there is unbelievable. I think where she go down to that hospital, take an example of the way it's run, and set the standard for all the private hospitals. This is the way we want the Alzheimer's people to be looked after. And set up a pathway so that when you're diagnosed with Alzheimer's, that they know where to go.
Yeah, because isn't that that's the extraordinary thing, that if you have cancer or you have a stroke or you have a cardiac issue, there are care pathways that, you know, everyone knows what the next steps are.
Yeah.
But we don't have those kind of care pathways for dementia and Alzheimer's.
We don't. And simple things, as I said to you, Sasha, if Maeve could even understand the way to talk to her husband, because what I've learned from going down to the hospital below, I used before COVID, go down 2 hours every day, 7 days a week. And watching the way they look after the patients is unbelievable, the way they do it. They agree and distract. You don't ever go against them. Never. You just agree and distract, and it works. And like when I go down there, and no matter what care person comes in that door, every one of the patients will start smiling. That tells me enough. They're all cared for. Every place should be run like that place for Alzheimer's, without a doubt.
And is everybody in where Maeve is now, or where Julie is now, is a dementia patient?
Yeah. It's a dementia unit especially, and that is the way they should be cared for. They should not be put in with people who are elderly, not to suspect, not people who are elderly, because they will not cope with that situation. People who haven't Alzheimer's can't contact or even talk to people who have Alzheimer's. They don't know how.
Tell me, when COVID struck then, Martin, and suddenly all those visits, all that amount of time you were able to spend with Julie stopped. How was that?
Yeah. Because, like, I kept saying, if I lose that connection, I'm finished. And that's the one thing that I'm trying to hold. And it, thank God, is still there. And I got a letter in today which said that I can have 2 hours every second day, which is great. Brilliant. Now, I understand why they've done that. But like my wife don't understand that. When I go down and visit her for the half hour for the week.
That's all you have at the moment, is it? One half hour a week.
Yeah. 1.5 hour. And if my daughter goes down, I don't get that week. I have to go from the next week. So like, you could have a half an hour for 2 weeks. And when you look, when she's at the other side, I know all her expressions, every one of them, with 42 years. I can see her looking and she's saying to me, what are you doing over there? Can't you come over to me? And you can't explain. How can you explain? So you're going away. You can't describe the pain when you're going away. You can't.
But despite, and obviously that it's been such a difficult time for everyone with someone they love, and particularly, as you say, people that can't understand it, like in Julie's situation. But you say that when she got that place in Dungarvan Community Hospital in the dementia unit, that you started living again.
Oh, yeah. I could not, and I can't praise them enough. I can't. Everyone could find exactly the same thing as I found. Because really, how can I say that I'm happy when I'm not? But it just changed my life. Because I come away, up home, happy, knowing Julie's looked after. And that means everything.
And you're expecting good news in November?
Yeah, my daughter, Siobhan. Hopefully everything will go well. I hope it will fall. Looking forward to bringing the baby down to Jewel.
Your first grandchild.
Yeah. So, like, that'll be a big one. It was a big one when they got married. We had to bring Julie, who was in the home at the time, bring her out. That was hard. That was tough. Because, like, walking up the aisle, I had two decisions in my head. I said, my wife is above on the top of Alzheimer's. She hasn't the clue. I'm walking down my daughter. What can you do? That was tough. When I turned around, when I handed Siobhan to Dave, and I turned around, she had her two hands out. Well, where can you go? This disease is cruel. Cruel.
It is a cruel disease. There is no doubt about that. Martin, thank you so much for calling and offering your support to Maeve, because you really did want to let her know.
Oh, definitely.
You can turn this around.
Yeah. Oh, you can. You can. But it is hard. It is hard. The government should do more. Now we have a minister in Waterford, Mary Butler, who's over the elderly. I hope she will step up to the plate.
What is the main thing that you learned over that time, though, that those hard years that you went through with Julie?
It just you find yourself really, but at the same time, it just tears the heart out of you. There is no day will go by that. It's a living death, that's the way they describe it, and it is. It's a living death. You can't. You just can't come to terms with it. You can't.
Yeah, but at least, as you say, you have the comfort of knowing that Julie is getting the best care she possibly can get.
That's the only thing. That's a consolation.
Okay, Martin, thank you so much for that. I'm going to bring in Mary now. Mary Whelan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. Martin, what wonderful speaker, and covered so many of the things that I would love to be saying as well. I was very touched by listening to Maeve yesterday afternoon.
Because you also knew where she was coming from.
Oh, yes, indeed. I do very well know where she's coming from, because my husband, Tony, has Alzheimer's. He has been diagnosed now. He's coming up to 72, and he's been diagnosed formally since he was age 60, but we would have noticed the first symptoms at around age 58. And, of course, the symptoms in the early stages are so scattered and so infrequent that you don't put them all together. They would have happened over periods of time, like not finishing reading a book, then not reading, and he was an avid reader. If we ever had rows about anything, it would have been about a light left on all night reading books, you know? Mm. So those sort of simple things, but then, you know, you put that down to many other things, because we actually had a bereavement within the family at that time that I actually thought perhaps he was suffering from depression. He also retired. Now, we were in the fortunate position that he was able to retire early, because we were both in a nursing profession where you could leave, and he made that decision very fast, and that's something that I always think, looking back, you see, in retrospect, it's easy to put it all together. So with Tony, it's been a slow, very slow process. He lives at home here, and he is very well physically. I don't have the physical things to worry about, but everything else is very different. And I suppose what Martin spoke about there is a big thing that I would have an issue with, is the no care pathway. Now, I wouldn't need or ever have needed all the services when Tony was diagnosed just over 12 years ago. But certainly in the intervening time, I certainly have needed services. But if I had been given a care pathway at that time, I could link into it as time went on. And very real, as you said earlier, if it had been a diagnosis of another illness, you wouldn't be told, or the comment wouldn't be at the end of getting the diagnosis, wouldn't be, well, have you family that will help you out? Because if you get a serious illness, it's not something that's said to you, indeed, as you get the diagnosis.
And was that said to you?
Oh, indeed it was, yes, and has been said many times. And I feel quite passionate that families, firstly, aren't trained in how to look after somebody that has a health issue. And secondly, they have to have their own lives to live. We're in the position that two of my children live abroad, one in Australia, one in England, and I have one living down the country and one that is in we're in Dublin, and one that is in Dublin but has to work for a living, and they're very good and excellent, and there wouldn't be a day that goes by that I'm not supported by them. But
but they have their lives, yeah.
But they have their lives. It shouldn't be an expectation that the family are going to mind the person. Now, I have chosen, and we, unlike Martin, one of the things would be that we talked quite a lot about the illness in the first 4 years when Tony was able to talk about those things. And
at that point, just because I'm very struck by how young you would both have been at that stage.
Yes, and I was still working at that time.
And
yes,
how frightening that diagnosis can be for people.
It's very frightening. And from both of us, I mean, we were coming from a profession that we would have been involved in people getting diagnoses similar to it. So you think you would be prepared for that, but you're not, because it's yours. It's being told to you. It's different. And
how did Tony react to that, or how did he, you know, in those early years?
I have to say he was very funny when the consultant told him that. He just said to the consultant, the consultant asked him, did he want to know the diagnosis? And he just said, yes, I'm paying you for that. And I thought that was a nice line. But yes, he accepted it well, certainly. God, there were many days of loads of tears, so there was. Sometimes we talked about what the future might hold, but lots of times we just chose to stay in, as they would say, in the moment. We sort of didn't look further than about 3 months at a time. And I think that's something for Maeve at her stage, try not to be thinking too far ahead. Try and stick with think of this week at the moment. You know, if you start thinking about where we might be, that was one thing that the consultant was very good about. If you started at that, yes, you could be in a deep depression before you would need to be in the deep depression, if you know what I mean.
That it could be overwhelming, just the
very overwhelming, yeah. Very overwhelming. And indeed, we kept very much the normality of life, so we did, and that's as far as you can, certainly. And there was, but you had to be practical and sensible. You had to, if you went someplace, you had to make sure that if Tony went to the bathroom, you would stay outside, because when he came out, he mightn't remember whether it was right or left he was going. And those kinds of things can look very odd when you're in company, to the extent that somebody once said, God, I never realised that woman was so possessive about her husband, which is because the man looks so normal, naturally enough, they wouldn't realise that he had a problem, you know.
And did you share what was happening with your, you know, wider circle of family
yes.
and friends, yeah?
Very much so. That was the one thing. And in the beginning, he was excellent at explaining to people how he felt and the way it was. And that was really good. We, from day one, we never hid it. And I think that made a huge difference to life and to, you know. Now, not everyone is comfortable knowing it, but unfortunately, we can't, you know, I suppose, look after the comfort of other people. But the, most people were very good and understanding about it. And it's great to see, once people know that, they will look out for you. And I think that's something that is important for Maeve. Martin certainly seems to have taken that on board as well. So he does, you know.
You just, you sound so kind of chirpy and practical and competent and on top of things. I'm just like, you've had, it's been what, 12 years since your diagnosis?
12 years of practice now, Katie. That is, yes, indeed. I am chirpy most of the time, and most of the time it's good. Yes, of course. And indeed, when I think about it, I have fears. You know, I think one of my big fears really is that I won't remember what Tony was like before, you know, this hit, because 12 years is a long time, you know. Mm-hmm. Photographs are great, and of course the modern technology of having recordings, etc., that's really good, you know, but it is hard. Now, the battle that was the hardest was to get care, because again, when he was he wasn't 65 when I could recognise that we needed to have more. My big concern was that to keep him mentally stimulated. I knew that if I could keep that going, that would prolong his life in every way, and also the quality of life. So the battle began, and contacted our public health nurse, and we did, after lengthy period of time, I got a day in the day centre, which wasn't specifically for Alzheimer's, but they are wonderful and have been fantastic. He also knew people there, and that did help. And then I realised that I needed, you see, 24 hours doing any job, even the job perhaps that you love, you wouldn't like to be put on the radio for 24 hours. So 24 hours is hard, and I realised that we needed carers. And that was a battle, because you were given the answer that there are very ill people in your parish, in your, you know, locality, and they need the hours, because it's all based. So I have to say...
Oh, like they need the hours more than you, basically.
Oh, yes, yes, basically. So guilt is a huge thing. I could write guilt in 6-foot letters. That's, you always are made to feel that. And even when you get the hours, you still feel the guilt, because you're terrified that someone else is doing without them. What I would say to Maeve is, you write to the letter, and you write it to your HSE local office. You also send it to the minister, and I heard Martin mentioned that the minister, junior minister, is local to him there. She's also a woman, and most of them, and indeed I know that the head of the HSE is good and does understand about Alzheimer's. So I wrote the day-to-day things. I wrote a saying that, basically, how would you like if you applied for your annual leave, and the 2 weeks annual leave that you were to get, that you were told no, you can't have them because there's no one to cover your office, you know, etc. And you were something specifically you wanted to go, and that's the case with respite. Now, respite is on hold, of course, now, mm-hmm. but that's understandable. But you couldn't plan that you wanted to go someplace, you know what I mean?
But when you say that, you know, she needs to write and find her
yes,
public health nurse and go to the
yes.
politicians. And I'm thinking yes. about Maeve and you know, the exhaustion in Maeve's voice
of it, yes,
yesterday.
And
would you have it in you, and how could you turn around and start, you know, launching a big admin campaign for something that really you would have thought should be pretty basic?
Oh, yes, you think it's basic, and I have to say that was really hard. So I wouldn't have done it. I would have done it in fits and starts is the best way to describe it. And sometimes I parked it because you just couldn't get the energy up, you know, and then something would occur and you would go back. So eventually I got the care hours, and then they were increased in that. They're for social care. They're to give me a break as well, so that I have the energy to keep going for the rest of the day and be... Because you are on, you're on call the whole day, so you are, everything is, you're the full resource when you're at home. And it is my choice and our family choice that as far as possible we will mind Tony until things, if to change. But we are realistic in that we're not saying we wouldn't choose residential care, you know.
And does Tony require 24/7 care at this stage, or
total supervision? So when it comes to anything, to he loves his food, so that's fine once it's chopped up and safe and all the rest of it. But wouldn't feed. I mean, if I went out, wouldn't feed himself. Never, or you couldn't leave him on his own, so you couldn't. Safety would be an issue. And then when it comes to personal care, yes, he can do it under supervision. Again, it's all supervision, everything would be. But you could have two socks on the one foot, to be honest with you, Katie, at any given day. But, you know, you get around it. And again, Martin's thing about agreeing and distraction, yes. So sometimes if the morning getting ready, which can take a long time now, you might have to restart because he can do something, but if he got distracted in the middle of it, he mightn't be able to, you know, you couldn't say we'll start that, so you might have to restart the whole process again. But those are things you learn as you go along, you know.
And they're so the physical things, obviously, and then there's just a huge emotional...
Oh, yeah, it's the emotional part, so there is indeed, yeah. It's very different, isn't it, from what you anticipate in your retirement years. I also wrote that to the departments when I wrote to them about, you know, what the normal expectation of any worker is when they retire, that they're going to do maybe X, Y, and a Z. But for us, the retirement just didn't happen because, you know, it's, we physically aren't at work. But the dreams and the hopes and the things that you might want to do, they just weren't possible.
They weren't possible.
Yeah.
Will you stay there with me, Mary? I want, because I think we have Maeve back on the line now. Maeve,
yes. Do
we have you?
Hello. Yes, I'm here. Maeve here. Yeah, thank you.
Maeve, I'll let Mary just address you directly because I think she's a lot further down the road than yourself and I think she has some very good advice for you.
Yeah.
Mary.
I was listening to Mary there. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome, Maeve, but I feel, you know, you're wonderful to have come on. I have to say, I would never have had the courage to come on, only the researcher contacted me as a result of a tweet. It really is a very hard, and when I say about the battle, you know, sometimes, yes, you fall down and you're exhausted, and yes, you do feel like giving up, but then after that comes the energy to do the battle, and certainly your public health nurse is your first person to contact. And no matter what service you contact, and if you're not receiving the what you need, there is within that service there's always a supervisor. They mightn't like the fact that you contact a supervisor. Yeah. I know that myself. There may be a little black mark against me and some people, but you do have to go that way. You're not battling just for yourself, Maeve. You're battling for your good husband. You're battling. Yeah. You're also battling for other people. That's what I feel. So that's yes, indeed. So hopefully you'll get all those things.
Maeve.
Well, I have, since 2017, I have been in contact with my public health nurse many times. Like, and even last week, I was more or less begging for a respite, you know, crying down the phone. She knew I really needed it, you know, and still I was told, you know, the same thing as I always say, there's no resources at the moment. It'll be a long time before there's anything and really no hope, you know, and when you hear that,
sadly, that's a one-liner that I have got many times, indeed, and it definitely...
So many times,
It's like a punch when you get that, and you fall down and you don't want to get up. But then you do, because you're so caring for the person that you're looking after and so passionate about it, and you think about... You do get up again and you go, and... Yeah, and I have sympathy for the public health nurses because I know that often they haven't got resources, but that's not good enough for an answer to any of us that are looking after people with Alzheimer's and dementia. And that's thousands and thousands of us. It's not just you and me. So, you know, so within that, your parish, your area, wherever you are, Maeve, there must be others as well. Unfortunately, with COVID, we're all separated now and we can't meet and support each other. Yeah. That's the other side. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us to support. But within the HSE, the public health nurses work within a system. And if you have a look at the website, you will see where you can go there to look at the next stage. Respite is difficult at the moment, but there are other things other than respite. There are, you know, someone to come into your home and assist you, you know.
Yeah, Maeve, I mean, we got such a huge response to your story yesterday. So many people really felt for you and really were thinking about how they would feel and that's in your situation. I mean, obviously, what Mary's saying there, you shouldn't have to fight for this, but... it looks like you are going to have to battle away.
Yeah. And I suppose, I feel I have been, you know, especially in recent weeks and months.
Yeah.
But I feel it has been a battle. And I'm the same as Mary there. You know, I was told in the beginning as well, have you any family to help you out? They kind of push a lot for that, you know, to encourage you to get family to help out. But, you know, family can only do so much as well, you know, and, you know, your children are great, our children are great and helped me out brilliantly in the early stages. But as things progress, it's not so easy for them to manage, you know, with a disease they know nothing about either. You know, so, and when our disease was quite rapid as well, it was rapid for my husband, you know, the way it happened so quickly in just such a few short years. You know, the shock for us all to kind of prepare and deal with it and
get
help as well.
The big thing, I don't know about you, but the big thing I would feel as well is that there is no there's no counselling service at all associated with the Alzheimer's, stroke, dementia diagnosis. And I think it's huge that isn't there for everyone in connected to the person, but particularly the spouse or partner and the children, because the big word is, apart from guilt, that we have 6-foot letters of that, but loss is the big thing, and every day is loss. And that's very hard. Yeah. It's loss of everything, loss of what you can't do, but loss of the dreams and the hopes as well, you know, because you're extremely young and your husband, you know, so it's very difficult to see your life cut down like that.
It is. Mary, I'm going to cut you there just for a moment.
Yep.
Please stay with us. Stay with us, Maeve and Martin. I want to take a break, but I want to continue this conversation after these. 51551 is our text line.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And it's Katie Hannon sitting in for Joe. And I want to go now to Linda O'Sullivan. Good afternoon, Linda.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
You were listening to Maeve and Mary and Martin there. You lost your nana just a couple of weeks ago.
I am. So today, 2 weeks ago, sadly, we lost my nanny. She was diagnosed with dementia 5 years ago, and at first it was quite slow progression, and 3 years ago she lost her son suddenly, and really since then it deteriorated. And then when lockdown happened, also just to mention, she was cared for at home always, that was her wish. She had always said, I want to go to a nursing home if I ever become a burden, but we knew she didn't. She always wanted to be with her family. So March came, she went into hospital with a chest infection, which we now know was pneumonia. She came back home and then she went back in because just the level of care, her GP was excellent, but the level of care she required due to she wasn't feeding, she wasn't drinking, we knew then she needed to go to hospital. And when she was in there, the whole team met and said that there was nothing more that could be done for her. And she was transferred home to die, basically, which was what the whole family wanted. But in our situation, I suppose, different to the rest, everyone was in agreement that what my nanny would have wanted was to be cared for at home, and that's what was done for the 5 years that she had the illness.
Mm-hmm.
When we got her home then to die, obviously we couldn't give morphine, we couldn't give the drugs that's needed to assist with somebody that was dying. So St. Francis Hospice came every day to administer the morphine, to see how we were getting on, and just a whole family effort. Our family would be very close, but my mum, her brother, her two brothers and her sister, my mum's sister was her official carer, and they took over her care. And like what we hear of Katie every day, unconditional love is what we imagine with a parent and a child, but what I've seen, the unconditional love is when you see your family caring for somebody that's dying. I mean, that's time that you'll never, it's moments like that you cherish.
Yeah. And Linda, you were saying that when you listened to Maeve and you heard Maeve yesterday on the programme, that it brought a lot back to you about the years caring for your nan.
My nanny, it started off kind of, there was one or two things where she'd forget the name of something. Then all of a sudden her ability to spell, she couldn't. She'd point at an object and she would say remote control. She wouldn't get the word. And she'd know herself. She'd say, I can't get the word out. I can't say it. And then slowly, I'd say 3 years ago, she wouldn't recognise who was there, who was caring for her. And now she was always very happy at home, but there was occasions where she'd get anxious. She'd want to leave the home. A couple of weeks before she really went downhill, she asked to go home to her mammy and her daddy. She tried. I remember one of the times where we knew that she needed it, my mum and my sister came home. This is when she wasn't supervised all the time, when we didn't think things were that bad. Mm-hmm. And she'd a frozen chicken fillet on the gas cooker. And it was after that we realised that she'd need 24-hour care. She couldn't be left on her own. But as I said, it was very slow. And then at the end, it was very quick. So really in March, when I look back now, it was like they sent us home somebody else, because it was overnight. She stopped speaking. She was sleeping. It was just like somebody flicked off a switch and she was there, but she wasn't there.
Yeah, and that's really what Maeve was describing to us yesterday, what the diagnosis from some odd, you know, seizures and stuff at the start.
Yeah.
That the progression of the illness has been fast.
The progression of the illness is so different in people that you'd often look at my nanny and say, she's fine, she seems fine. But then it changes so rapidly that, you know, one minute you're able to care for them. But we were very adamant always to keep her at home. But when it came to not eating, that's just that level. We couldn't keep her at home. There was dehydration and everything. And it broke my mum's heart and her siblings' heart that we had to let her go to hospital, because we were terrified if she got COVID, that was going to be it. But she really, it was very slow. And then it progressed so badly, but our only saving grace was that she was brought home to die and she got to see her grandchildren, and her grandchildren were her world. She loved all of us and she would have wanted all of us to be with her. So that past week, I think all of my mum's siblings took off work, all of the grandchildren. We just had a rota of the whole family were around her constantly until then when she passed. And the day that she passed, I just got a feeling, Katie, I can't describe it. My own children were in bed. I live on the same road as my mum. And I got this feeling and I said, she's going to go today. And I ran down to my mum. I didn't even speak to my mum at the door. She let me in and I just kissed her and I said, I love you, Nanny. And that was the last time that I spoke to her. And then she went.
And you just had that instinct from wherever that comes from.
I don't know where it comes from, but it's almost like it's a peace, because 2 weeks prior to that, her sister had died. She had dementia as well, but she died of a heart condition that was, you know, she'd always suffered with. And the saddest thing, I think, besides getting the dive that Nanny was going, was myself and my sister sat holding her hand while her sister's funeral was on the laptop in front of us. And the rest of our family went to the mass. Well, they stood outside because of COVID. And she didn't even know that her own sister had passed. And that was a decision we had to take because we were afraid at that stage that that would trigger her to get worse or to upset her.
Linda.
It was just that moment, Katie, that her own sister and the priest had mentioned my nanny's name, and there was, I mean, she had no inkling that that was what was happening.
But what strikes me about your story is that your nanny was so lucky, really, because she had so much care and love, and there were siblings there to rally round. There's a bit of a contrast to the situation
Horrible.
That Maeve finds herself in.
Oh, Maeve, I just can't even I can't even imagine, because my family all had discussions about care, whether she'd go and get care, what she needed. And if we didn't have the people that we have, that would have been us. And I've seen so many cases and so many people come and say to you, that happened to my nanny, that happened to my mother, we couldn't get her care. Because it gets to a stage, although we had family that were caring for her, at one stage the hospital said to my uncle, it took six of them to lift her in the bed, six adults to lift her. And I mean, to think of poor Maeve, because time will come where they do lose the ability to walk themselves. They lose the ability to feed them. And, I mean, the HSE were fantastic. The local office, they gave us things that we needed, the hospital bed at home. But, I mean, it's hard and it's physical work and it's demanding work, you know. And nobody should ever feel that they have to do that because they're left with no choice, you know. Like, the disease is cruel. And I from your other guest there, you lose a part of them every day, and it's like it's grief from the moment they get that diagnosis until the end, because you're losing a part of them every day, every single day, and you never get that part back.
That's it. I'm going to take another break because there is more listeners who want to share their stories. Linda, thank you for that.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And we were talking to people's stories about their experience with their loved ones and Alzheimer's. Maeve, as I say, a huge amount of support coming through on our text line and on our phone lines for you. I know it's not going to solve your problem when you wake up on your own with your husband tomorrow, but does it give you some comfort to know there are so many other people who know what you're going through?
Yes, it does, yeah. I mean, The three callers, they're all very good, and I know the advice they give and everything is brilliant, and I can totally relate to each one of them. Linda's nanny there was very lucky that she had everyone to care for her, and I'm sure she would have been very proud of them to bring her home, for her to, you know, be able to die at home with her family. You know, they sound like very supportive. And
yeah, and of course we should say it again, because you said it yourself yesterday. Your children and your husband's children have been very supportive of your situation as well. But but as you say, this is not how it should be.
Yes, they were very supportive when they could, but now that we're kind of in the later stages, it's not easy for them, you know, to manage, you know, the day-to-day, the physical side of things, you know, how to, you know, manage. And I couldn't expect them to either. I mean, they're not equipped, or, you know, they have no experience of this.
And
you
again,
know,
sorry, Maeve, if I can just get you to set out before I let you go, exactly what would make your life better now? What could help you cope and continue to do what you want to do, which is be responsible for, you know, and look after your husband of all these years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first I would have needed respite, you know, before now, so that I didn't kind of reach this breaking point, you know. And, you know, I would have needed carers, I suppose, that were able to manage the dementia, because I'm not sure. I think it was Martin there that said about, you know, you need specialist carers for dementia. Where his wife is, there are specialist carers. Because, I mean, it's different how you handle dementia patients as regards than the older people. You know, it's kind of a different set of skills you need to a certain extent. You know, so I suppose, I mean, I would have needed, respite and home care.
And are you still hoping that somehow at the end of some phone call, you'll be told, okay, you can have the respite, you can have the home care?
Well, at the moment, I'm looking for long-term care, because I know that no respite is coming, and I was kind of told that there won't be anything in the short term. But of course, now with the COVID-19 as well, there definitely won't.
And is that it for you then, Maeve? You have kind of come to terms with the fact that that's where your husband is going to be?
It seems to be. I mean, it's not what I ever wanted, but at the moment I know I can't manage at home on my own because I'm not going to be getting any help in the near future. I mean, even our public health nurse said, you know, that there's just not the support in the community. And yet, like recently too, our government, you know, was talking about people being, you know, they want to kind of see, maybe put in place something in the future that more people could stay at home. But I mean, without support, we won't be able to do that. We won't be able to keep them at home. And that's what I had always wanted for my husband, was to be able to stay at home with us. You know, I knew maybe near the very end of the disease that I would have to let him go somewhere. But I suppose he is at an advanced stage now. That's the other thing.
And right now, just to remind people, Maeve, right now he is in the psychiatric unit of your local hospital.
Yes. And I still can't see him at the moment. You know, they're not allowing anyone in.
And you have no care plan in place? You don't know what next?
I'm trying. I'm ringing a lot of nursing homes at the moment and I can't get anybody. Some places, they won't even put his name on the list. Other places say they have no places at all. Or they don't have the resources to cope because they already have a few dementia patients that are kind of require a lot of care and they just wouldn't have the resources to take someone else on at the moment.
And obviously as well, you want somewhere that you're going to be able to visit him regularly and easily.
You know, yes. And I am ringing some places that are not very close to us because, you know, I'm just kind of running out of options. Mm-hmm. But last year I did contact, a place in Ireland here that they specifically look after dementia, people with dementia, you know, it was purpose built mm-hmm. for dementia patients. And somebody came here to visit us at home and assess my husband to see, you know, if he would be suitable for a place there. But she just came back to me a few days later to say that she couldn't take him because he was too advanced, which I was, you know, totally surprised.
Right.
With, you know, because
you were caring for him at home.
Him to go in.
Exactly,
I wanted him to go into care because he was advanced. I mean, if he wasn't, there's no way I would want him to be anywhere else except at home.
Yeah.
You know, so that was very disappointing as well. I mean, just the help doesn't seem to be there, the kind of help that I need, I suppose.
Well, I hope, Maeve, I wish you the very, very best and I hope that in the very short term, you get the answers you want and you get a place for your husband. And it works out as Martin described. He began to live again when he got that place for his wife, Julie. And I hope, as I say, I wish you the same. So, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
OK, thank you very much, Katie. Yes. Thanks,
Maeve.
Just have to see how things go. Thank you very much.
Best of luck, Maeve. Best of luck. 55551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.